Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. We're honored today to have as our premier guest, Andre Debuse III, the author of House of Sand and Fog, Bluesman, and The Cage Keeper, and other stories. Andre and I have not spoken prior to this interview. This is the first in the series, and it's a thrill for me to have Andre Debuse, and I will no longer use the third during the interview, as our first guest today. Andre, welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate this interview.
Well, Casey, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor for me.
Tell me a bit, if you would, about The House of Sand and Fog, because it was really a phenomena, and you went, I love the story I read as you were writing House of Sand and Fog, that a lot of it you wrote while you were in your car. And if you would, I find that story fascinating. If you would, just tell the listeners and the readers and writers out there the process, how long it took you to do that.
Sure. Well, I write longhand pencil in notebooks, so I don't need. This was before I have a laptop now, but I didn't have one then. Although I still write longhand, and you know, my wife and I are blessed with young children, and we live in a small little place. We did then. And there was just really no quiet place to go. And I'm one of those writers who does need quiet. I like that cork-lined room T.S. Eliot talked about. I didn't have an office at the university. I did, actually, but I shared it with five other adjuncts, so I couldn't write there. And, you know, you can't sit in a restaurant and write because it's loud and you got to buy stuff, and I was broke. So one day I realized, man, my car is awfully quiet. And so I got into this habit very early in the morning, about 6 o'clock, I'd get in the car, and for years I would, one day a week, I mean, about 3 days a week, I would teach writing at various colleges in the Boston area, and then the alternate days I'd do carpentry work, remodeling houses. So either a carpentry or a teaching day, I'd pull over and I'd just sit in my car and write, and it was funny, I actually began by parking near a Dunkin' Donuts, and I get a coffee there, and about 7 days into this, a police car pulled up, and I was in an apartment complex parking lot, and the cop came out, and I knew him because I was a bartender, and he was one of my customers, and he came over, and we said hi, and he said, "So what are you doing?" I said, writing a novel. I felt so silly, writing a little novel. I was showing him my notebooks, and oh, that's right. Yeah, I knew you were a writer. He said, "Oh," I said, "Why are you asking me, John?" He said, "Well, the people here—they've been watching you parking here for a week. They want to know what the hell you're up to." So I felt terrible, and I. He said he'd go explain to them, but I said no. So I left, and I took a left turn, then I took a right, and the first like and I was in the middle of the scene, so I just wanted to get back to work. And what I found, what I was in was a cemetery, and I parked next to a gravestone, and I wrote next to the grave of a lady named Jane Shaheen for about a year and a half, and then I found an even nicer graveyard closer to my house. What I found was if a cop pulls through a graveyard and sees somebody writing in a notebook near a grave, they just think it's some private thing you're doing with a dead loved one, they leave you alone.
Yeah, that makes sense. I thought you were going to say you switched locations because you're eating all the donuts.
Right. And then, I wrote the whole book in my car, and the man whose grave I wrote next to after that was a guy named Hylas T. Wheeler, who died in 1866 at age 33.
Wow.
I feel this fondness for Hylas.
Absolutely.
I think about him a lot.
Absolutely. That's fabulous. Now, I understand, before we discuss the novel, I understand you and your brother Jeb built a house. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, man, I'm still building it.
Still building it?
It's taken forever because it's a big house, and it's just Jeff designed it. He's not an architect, but he's a beautifully gifted artist and carpenter over the years. He designed it for me and my wife, and he and I and a buddy built it. Get this, man. We built it two winters ago in the coldest winter in 100 years in New England.
Wow.
40 days in a row is below 30 degrees below zero. I don't know how the hell we did it. And we actually got used to it, and you know, and then we sheathed the house in the wettest spring in 65 years, and then we roofed it during a heat wave. And then I hired a third guy, and he said, "So what's next, guys? Locusts?" But it's been, I got to tell you, man, it is a beautiful, rich, I would say even holy experience to build your own dwelling. I highly recommend I mean, I don't recommend people go buy and build a house as big as the one I'm building. It's a huge ordeal. But I recommend people just go build themselves a shack, man. There's just something to it about building your own dwelling.
I believe it. And you told me you ran into some difficulties, and as anyone who has read House of Sand and Fog or seen the film knows, it was really kind of freaky about how the plot line of House of Sand and Fog involves a woman, Kathy, who struggles with addictions and just simply doesn't, she kind of ignores her bills, and eventually her house is jeopardized, and Colonel Barani comes in, and the center of the story is about this struggle over the ownership of a home.
Yeah, it's ironic. I in the process of building this house, one reason I'm still building it, and actually my wife and I are doing the siding now, and she's afraid of heights, and God bless her, she's up there 35 feet off the ground shingling, but we had this huge reason we're still working on this house almost 2 years later is we had a 6-month delay because there was a bureaucratic snafu with the septic system. It was misdesigned by the engineers, and the state was threatening to tear my house down because it was non-compliant and just leave me to sue the engineers. And I couldn't believe the irony.
Yeah, I mean,
right, because here's a house I'm able to build from a book I wrote about a lady who loses her home due to a bureaucratic snafu, and I almost lose it due to a bureaucratic snafu.
That's so bizarre. It's
it
sounds like a bad novel.
It does. Yeah, I'm not writing a sequel.
Good. So, but luckily that's behind you now, and it's full speed ahead, right?
Yeah, we're
great.
Really enjoying it. Summertime, we're out there shingling, and it's good.
That is great. You know, one of the things that fascinated me about House of Sand and Fog, which I don't know that you've talked about, is Kathy, one of the protagonists, is struggling with her addictions, and she tries a thing called rational recovery.
Yeah.
And most of the time people use Alcoholics Anonymous, and they have them struggle with going to meetings. And rational recovery is a movement that kind of flourished a bit in the 90s, but you don't hear too much about it anymore. And I'm wondering why you chose rational recovery versus AA or psychiatry or something like that.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, because I thought it was a pretty significant part of our first story, and you know, not many people have talked about it, and I was very intrigued by rational recovery. For me, Casey, I don't know about how it works with you or other writers you've talked to, but for me, I only do research when I find myself writing myself into a corner about which I know nothing. So I can't even begin to imagine what would happen without knowing some specifics. So I have to get on the phone and make some calls and do some research. And so I called this detox treatment facility, and just to find out what a normal day was for someone doing a 28-day program, and when are the meetings, and who do they see, and then she said, well, and then at 3 o'clock you can go to AA or RR.
Mm-hmm.
And what the heck is RR? She told me, and I went and bought the book written by the man who founded RR, and I thought it was, frankly, it sounds like a disaster to me. I think it sounds wrong. It sounds like, I think very few people could probably stop drinking and doing drugs with rational recovery. But dramatically, I really thought it was intriguing.
Oh, I think it's brilliant, because for the listeners that aren't really familiar with alcoholism and drug addiction, and in the world we live in today, most people have someone in their extended family who falls into that category.
Mm-hmm.
Really, there in my experiences, there's really only one way to deal with that, and that's complete abstinence. And whether a person does that through AA or a spiritual awakening or however that happens, I don't think I've ever seen a case where a person really has been able to do something like rational recovery and continue to drink 2 or 3 beers a week if they truly are alcoholic.
That's right. I mean, if as you know, if someone's really an alcoholic, they can't just do those 2 or 3 beers.
Yeah.
I think that might work for someone who has been abusing alcohol but does not have the disease of alcoholism.
Exactly. There is a line between heavy drinking and alcoholism.
Right.
And did you attend any meetings of rational recovery? Or?
No, I did read the man's book. I believe his name is, God, his name escapes me, but I read his book, and I've seen some AA meetings.
Yeah.
I worked in corrections and social services in my early 20s, and that was part of what we did with the inmates and bringing to meetings. So I sat in on some of those, and I thought they were beautiful. I loved AA meetings. I thought they were spiritually huge, and it felt right to me. I said, well, this is really a good way to just quit. I can't imagine how anyone would quit drinking without having this be part of it.
Yeah.
So dramatically, I was really taken by her taking that route.
Her
ex-husband, Nick.
Yeah. You're listening to the Casey Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. Our guest today is Andre Dubuce, and we've been talking about the novel House of Sand and Fog. And Andre, I read where Colonel Barani in the novel, you actually knew a gentleman who had a similar experience as the character in the novel.
Yeah.
And I think Ben Kingsley did such an amazing job of recreating that role on the screen.
I agree.
And I read, or I think Ben Kingsley said that your wife, did she send him a copy of the book?
This is a funny story. The book had been published about 5 days. And, you know, my family, my sister, my wife, my mother, they're big movie buffs. And, you know, they always talk about if a book's made into a movie. I honestly have never thought about it that much, honestly. That sounds disingenuous, but we can talk about that later. I don't feel that great about Hollywood as a writer. But so I got home from teaching late one night, it's about 11 o'clock, and my wife, Fontaine, said, well, I sent Ben Kingsley your book today. I said, what? What, Gandhi Ben Kingsley, the actor? She said, yeah. I said, well, how'd you find him? We have some friends, and she found his agent. I said, well, that's sweet, honey, but he's never going to get that book, and if he gets it, I'm sure he's not going to read it, but that was nice of you, sweetie. Next time, just throw one off a cliff, though. So, I just thought it was cute, and you know, okay, 3 years later, I'm sitting in a movie set. It is the film of House of Sand and Fog. He is the lead actor, and we're doing interviews, and I hear him say in his interview, oh, yes. Yeah, I won't do his accent.
Yeah.
Big, you know, lovely, elegant British accent.
Yes.
He says how the author's wife sent him the book, and she wrote a very lovely letter, which he quoted.
Wow.
And I said, damn, he got that book and read it.
Wow.
Yeah, so that when the director approached him with this screenplay, Kingsley said to him, well, I've already read it. He said, you read my screenplay? He said, no, I read the book, the author's wife sent
it. A screenwriter, right?
Yeah.
That is. Now, tell me a little bit about the director, and I'd like to talk a little bit about, there are some differences between the movie and the novel, and
yeah.
I think some people have seen the movie, and I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the difference, because there are some very, very different elements of the book and the movie. Tell me a little bit about the director, and when he approached you, and was it kind of a click thing? You knew that he got what you were writing?
It's a good story. You know, you get a lot of calls from Hollywood if you get 4 or 5 a year. That's a lot.
Yeah.
About a project. And this one, House of Sand and Fog, in about a year and a half, got about 140.
Wow.
It was like 5 or 6 a week. It was unbelievable. And I wouldn't talk to all of them. My agent would forward to me the people he thought had a good chance of getting the movie made. So, you know, so I talked to these people, famous and otherwise, established and not. And, you know, and it would always come down to the same thing. They would talk about how they liked the story and the characters and the dramatic tension, etc. And then they'd always say, well, we'll have to soften the ending. I said, what do you mean, soften the ending? I said, well, you know, it's a downer. We can't sell a lot of tickets on a downer. I said, buddy, it's a tragedy. What do you mean, soften the ending? And so I would politely hang up and thanks, no thanks.
Yeah.
So one day I get this call from this guy, and my agent sent him along and said, you know, he's never made a movie, but there's something about him, you should talk to him. So we talked about an hour. His name is Vadim Perelman. He's a Russian immigrant, grew up in Kiev. And we talked about our lives. It was just two guys talking. It was a good conversation. And he quite passionately said, listen, you know, you may get a lot of money from some big established film person, Hollywood, he said. But these are his exact words, Casey. He said, but they're going to take your baby, they're going to chain it to the radiator, and they're going to rape and kill it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you got my attention. What are you going
to
do?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's it's not hard to read between the lines on that statement.
Yeah, I love the brutal, I hated the image, but I
right.
loved that he had the passion to say it.
Exactly.
I said, all right, man, what are you going to do? He said, well, I'm not going to hurt your baby. I'm going to make the the story you wrote, and that's it. It's going to be a dark film, and that's it. And I believed him, and gave him the option right then, and then the very next day, he got Oprah-fied. So,
are you kidding me?
Oh, very next day.
The next day?
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. That is... I mean, that's bigger than hitting the lottery, you know, in the Mega Millions in terms of the odds of that happening.
You know, and people don't realize, I think some people even in the publishing industry they do realize, but Oprah herself didn't realize what the numbers are. As you probably know, Casey, the average literary book by, you know, the writers we all love and whose work will last way after us, they might sell 3,000 to 5,000 to 7,000 copies of any one book.
Exactly.
Right. That's you know, a commercial success for a literary book is 15,000, 20,000 copies. My God, crack open the champagne.
Yeah, particularly in hardcover.
Sure. So when Oprah Winfrey puts her magic wand on there, they sell at least 1 million copies. And I actually told Oprah this, and she didn't know that.
Are you kidding me?
It's very sweet. There was real naivete when she first started a book club. She said, "Hey guys, go get this book." Not knowing there are only 5 in existence.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly. So they take them off the remainder stack and put them back on the shelves and...
And the publishers scramble to you know, reprint them and get them out there. And, you know, Oprah has taken some flack, and I'll always stand by her. I mean, I think she does a public service with this thing. I felt that way even before she graced my life with that choice.
Yeah. You know, quite frankly, Andre, when I've had a lot of writers down here, I'm at the University of the South's Writers Conference, and one of the things that I've told people is when Oprah made her decision to switch from current fiction to the classics because of Jonathan Franzen's arrogance, or my perception of that being an arrogant move, whether it was or not, a light went on in my head, and I said, there are book clubs all over the country that are sitting around and they want to read something. And 100 Years of Solitude is a fabulous novel, but can 12 people read that in 30 days and discuss it intelligently? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
So I told my wife, I said, Tina Rich, I said, honey, I think there's a demand for authors to get exposure, for poets to read their poetry, for screenwriters to read their plays aloud. And with technology, we can pull this off. And that really was the genesis of what became the show that we're talking on today.
Wow, no kidding.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Because, you know, I think that what happens is, I know you're an avid reader, so, I mean, you know, you find an author's work, and then there's probably 10 other books behind it that are great.
Right.
And because it's not their first, I mean, it's gotten to the point where a lot of authors are publishing under pen names and selling more copies than they did under their own name because they couldn't get published with their own name anymore.
Yeah.
And that's ludicrous.
Yeah, it is.
So there's a hole in the system someplace, and we've got to figure out a way to fill it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I agree with you. I knew some of the people that Oprah had selected, and it was a wonderful thing. And this is the first time I've ever heard that she was not aware of the impact she was having on the number of copies being sold.
No, I don't think she knew, and... And I think she appreciated hearing that. It just helped her, I think.
Yeah. Now, how much heads up did you get before, like, the announcement was made? Because, I mean, you can't just go and print 1 million copies of books. I mean, that takes...
Oh, you know, it was kind of intriguing, and it was such a weird experience, man. I mean, it's the last thing I ever expected to happen, of course. I think Brett Lott said it really well. He's, you know, he wrote Jewel, and
yeah,
that was one of his novels was picked a few years ago. And he said, you know, expecting Oprah Winfrey to take your book for her book club and get that many readers just like that, he said, it's like expecting to walk down the street and get hit in the head with a moon rock. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, come on, man. She doesn't just pick new books. She picks anything off the shelf. It's, you know, 70,000 books are published every year in the United States.
Exactly.
You know, it just, how, anyway.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, and I think it's one of the things that I think people would rather write a book than read a book. And or a lot of people, and but for the people that are readers, there's nothing quite like the joy of discovering a new author.
Yeah.
And
well, I got this call. I was actually the only author she didn't call herself. She was on her plane and she couldn't get through to me on her plane, so I get this call from this lady with this thick, I felt like a Minnesota accent. She says, "Hi, I'm representing. I'm from Chicago. I'm in a fairly large book group." I said, "That's nice." I was cooking. My kids were playing. My wife was sewing slip covers upstairs for extra income.
Right.
It was just a hectic domestic scene. I couldn't quite hear. I said, "Oh, are you my friend Stephanie's friend?" "Oh, no, no, I'm calling for my friend." I said, "Who's your friend?" "Oh, Geth." I said, "Well, I don't know." She said, "Well, Geth, she's very important." I said, "I don't know, my friend Stephanie's important." So I'm stirring my sauce, and I said, "Where are you from again?" "I'm from Chicago, representing a fairly large book group." I didn't know the Oprah show was in Chicago.
Right.
And so she jumped. Finally, I said, "Oh, are you my friend Rachel's friend?" She said, "No, I'm calling for my friend." Finally, I said, "Oh, for crying out loud, who is it?" And I started to get this sick little feeling because some part of my brain had registered that the show was in Chicago. And I said, "This isn't TV related."
Right.
And she told me, and my first response was, "Man, you got to be shitting me." "Oh, I'm not shitting you."
Something out of Fargo.
Right, it was great. And then Oprah called a few days later. But yeah, you have to keep it a secret because she'd like to announce it on her show. So I couldn't tell anybody but my wife and my agent for about 3 weeks.
Wow. That must have been tough.
It was tough.
Yeah. And your agent, Phil Spitzer, is he's a beautiful guy. And we'll talk about him in the next segment. One of the things I'd like to talk about while we're on House of Sand and Fog is the character of Kathy.
Yeah.
And I've seen some, I've talked to some people that have seen the movie. And it is a tragedy. And in the movie, Kathy's character has a different ending than Kathy in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to give everything away because not everyone has read it or seen the movie. And I want people to read the book and see the movie. So how did you feel about that? I know your father was adamant about people not tinkering with even a comma. So how did you feel when that happened?
Well, I had mixed feelings. Well, first of all, I don't think it ends 180 degrees differently. It actually, the action stops short in the film where it continues in the book.
Okay.
Right, if you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, she is... If the movie were 25 minutes longer, it would have gone to the same place that the book goes.
Okay.
So I didn't feel as if it were a betrayal of the character, the scene. There are some action changes, which we have to speak vaguely about, which you know I'm talking about, which I really didn't like, and fought with but Dean said, "Hey, man, I thought you said you were going to change this." And it was the only heated discussions we had about the script.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually it was quite unusual. I was kept in the loop throughout the whole project, which is unusual. You know, normally the writer gets paid off and told to take a walk.
Right.
So I got to see script revisions, and when I saw that some of the action had changed towards the very end, I fought against it. I mean, fought for it, having it stay there, and he actually convinced me that cinematically it would be over the top if they had filmed exactly what was written. And they were actually in the DVD special features section of the thing. You can actually go and see some of these scenes that were filmed and deleted. He tried some of them.
Oh, great.
Yeah, you can see that. And we have to speak vaguely for people who haven't read it or seen it.
Yes, exactly.
But there are scenes with the Colonel and Kathy, for example, that they filmed and just didn't work. It was over the top.
Okay.
And so in that case, I went with it. But, you know, I, too, have over the years not allowed any changes. And I've said no to publications and all this other stuff when I felt they were... It's are you a dad?
Yes, I'm a step-parent.
Okay, so you know the feeling where I just think that... people have talked about this before, it's not original thought. I do think that the relationship between a writer and his or her characters is sometimes parental in that, you know, children, they're not ours, they don't belong to us. I mean, we're their guardians, and all we can do is do our best by them, then send them out there. And I think the same way you'd stand by your child and protect his or her integrity, I think you're supposed to stand by the characters and protect their integrity.
Mm-hmm.
As much as you can.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah.
And really, for those listening that aren't as familiar with the workings of Hollywood as Andre is, it is not uncommon for a producer to buy the rights to the film and really not even consult the author on.
But let me tell you, I think if there is in fact a devil, he lives in Hollywood. I think it is an absolute shithole, if I can use that word.
Sure you can.
I think it is horrible. I was alluding to this earlier. I know a lot of writers, understandably, I think it's especially when you're younger and you're craving some sort of attention, which is a normal process. You know, you think, well, if Hollywood calls, you know, I'll get a little splash of fame and fortune. Yeah, when they call, they're usually calling to do some damage to whatever beauty you're trying to create. That talent is designed to make money for a few people,
mm-hmm.
a bunch of money, and they will pervert, which is a beautiful word, by the way, which means to turn away from. They will pervert and twist and corrupt beautiful things to make money. And, you know, so when they call, I've always kind of reached my tire iron with one hand and squeezed the phone with the other. And also, not to be completely disingenuous, the truth is, hoping, well, can you give me some money, though, to take care of my family without selling my soul?
Mm-hmm.
You always listen to see if it's possible to not sell your soul. I don't know if it is, though, out there.
Yeah, yeah. It's that's something we could do a whole show on, just that,
mm-hmm.
that the temptation of...
say this, Casey, I do think, excuse me for interrupting,
yeah.
I do think that I feel really lucky about the film version of my novel, House in a Fog, because I do think that even given the changes we talked about, that ultimately the film is very loyal to the integrity of the characters.
Yes, I agree completely. And, you know, when I saw the film, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Affliction and the Sweet Hereafter that Russell Banks wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And those were both done... I thought the movie adaptations were very true to the story, and the characters were very believable and dark. And, you know, I think Hollywood doesn't give viewers enough credit for being willing to deal with these type of topics, because as human beings, we deal with them every day.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up. I've been asked that a lot because the story is a dark one. And, you know, by the way, my own writing process, I never know what's going on three or four words ahead of myself.
Right.
And I didn't set out to write a tragedy. I didn't set out to write a dark story. That's just where it went. And frankly, when it got to that point in the composition, I actually couldn't write for about 3 weeks because it was so painful and upsetting and disturbing.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's go back to Aristotle, the Greek definition of catharsis. It means to purify or cleanse. And I really believe that... You just mentioned it. We put up with loss and suffering all the time. It's part of the human condition. I think we live in such a neurotic culture because we're hell-bent on being happy and on putting a smiley face on it all, and we deny death and disease at every turn, and it's a great disservice to our very souls. I think our souls require a Mozart's Requiem. I think it requires a dark Scorsese film. I think it requires... you know, some deep, disturbing Van Gogh, because we're like the symphony, and a whole brass section is not being allowed to play, and it's making us sick.
I
think that it's very important for people to get into dark art. I'd rather have them suffer through art than in their lives, but they're going to get in their lives too, and the soul needs the truth.
Yes, and I think that perhaps one of the first writers that truly was able to explore that in a meaningful way was Raymond Carver and his characters. And when Carver began writing his stories, people identified. They said, wow, that's me. It's not, you know, the protagonist is not the president of the United States or a senator or the CEO of a major corporation. It's a guy that lives down the street. It's the guy that lives next door to me who has problems. And his problems are of interest to me.
Yeah. Very nice. Well said. You know, I read an epigraph to a Graham Greene novel a few years ago that I've been quoting probably too much, but I think it's a truth that we need to speak more often these days. Here's the line. Man has places in his heart which do not yet exist, and into them enter suffering in order that they may have existence.
Hmm.
I mean, nobody wants to suffer, but...
No. That's
isn't that a beauty?
That's a beauty. That's a beauty. It was
for them enter suffering in order that they may have existence.
Yes, it was suffering is something that there was the a dedication in or an epigraph in one of Jane Smiley's novellas, The Age of Grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm paraphrasing, so it's not a quote, but it says something to the effect of, I'm 35 years old and this is the age of grief. Eventually the cup passes around and we must all drink from it. And those that have not drunk from it, you know. And so,
mm-hmm.
I'm kind of like you. When I get a line like that, you know, I explain to people that grief is a natural part of human life, and we must drink from that cup.
Right.
And then we grow.
And also, I don't get too reductive or psychological here, but I also think that until you do that, you are never going to feel the joy.
No.
It's going to be muted. It's going to be tamped down. It's going to be, you know, you shut one door, you shut them all.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I don't know why it's so hard for our modern media to understand that some of the images we see are so horrific. Give us the benefit of the doubt when it comes to our art and our movies and our novels. And
I don't know what it is either, but I'm tired of being patronized, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Our guest today is Andre Dubuc III, and we're going to end this segment of the interview with Andre talking a bit of what young writers and new writers can do. And I'd like to invite you back for part two of this interview, which we will discuss Andre the Third's father, his work, and his life. And I urge you to listen to that interview as well, because if you have not discovered that world, you're in for a treat. So, Andre, if you would, what kind of advice would you give to young writers?
Well, I think there is some bad writing teaching going out there. By bad, I mean insincere. And I don't think particularly helpful. I guess here's the big thing I would say. I think that writers need to learn to trust their own imaginations and to trust their own abilities. I always counsel whatever writers I find myself working with to not outline their stories. Don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of established writers do it, but I suggest they try not doing it. Because I think what happens is when you start to plot out and plan your story, you sort of send a message to your imagination that you don't trust it. And I think when you do that, it's not going to want to show up and trust you. So I would say, trust what God's given you. Find the concrete, specific, sensual words that are the true words, not the ones that make us sound good or sensitive or talented or attractive, but the ones that actually nail the experience that's coming out of you. And then trust is going to lead somewhere meaningful and just free fall into it.
Beautiful. Andre, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And this has been the premier edition of the Casey Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. Join us next week when the topic will be the work of Andre Dubuc. Thank you for joining us today.